Hello and welcome to Movie Challenge Accepted. I am Jason.
And I am Marco.
And we're back, and this is our first remote podcast. Arco and I always, we're not in the same place. Arco's in Long Island. I'm in New England. Mm-hmm. On this particular day, I'm in a cabin up in Vermont, but I brought my gear.
Right.
So
you're
hopefully
it,
this will work. And I think it's probably appropriate that I'm up in New England. Mm-hmm. Snowy, bad weather. Oh. Well, not bad weather. I guess it's, you know, if you're into snow, you're a skier. But New England and weather and the sense of isolation kind of goes well with the movie I challenged you for this week.
Oh, boy. It sure does. I felt isolated watching this film. And this is this film, The Lighthouse, Eggers. Was
Robert Eggers.
Robert Eggers, right. I know that he worked with his brother on this film. Was the only film that you have challenged me with that I had to stop periodically and come back to. I know you've done that
really?
A couple of times on yours. And I don't know. But this one, for me, was very difficult to watch. It was... all right. Where do you want to start, Jason? Go ahead. Pick it apart.
All right. So Robert Eggers, he's put out two movies so far. Both take place in New England. He put out The Witch or The Vavitch, right. Depending on how you see it typed, right. In 2015. And then he put The Lighthouse out in 2019. Willem Dafoe, Robert Pattinson, basically the only two people on screen for 2 hours.
Right. Absolutely.
Black and white, square aspect ratio, a lot of horns blowing in the distance.
It's amazing. Everything that you're mentioning right now is the reason why this film, you know, messed with me so much. Let's start with the black and white. It was painful to watch. My eyes still hurt trying to make out what the hell I was seeing. I mean, sometimes black and white works well. I know that he did a couple of different things with his cameras to get this particular kind of effect. 1890 effect basically is what he was looking for, and I would say he got it, but at the expense of my eyeballs. Okay. And I had to stop a few times.
You know, it's funny you talk about that and about the way this is shot. The way this is shot is like one of the things I love most about this movie, and it's one of the things I love most about the two films of Eggers that I've seen so far, this and The Witch with Anya Taylor-Joy, right. Is I think he's one of the rare directors that has a distinctive look to his work. Right. And it's funny you say that The Lighthouse was so dark and so difficult, like physically difficult to watch to figure out what was going on. I had the same problem with Greenland, I think I told you two episodes ago.
Right, right.
Where there's a section in Greenland that takes place at night where I just had no clue what was going on. So I'm not gonna get on you if it didn't work for you visually.
As far as the way that he filmed it, I know that you are a stickler for the way that films are put together. So you're more on the technical side, while I am not. I grew up in the era of pan and scan at Blockbuster Video. When you see that on the side of a box, you knew that you were. You know, you knew you were in for a good night of action. So so this movie being the square block in the middle of a, you know, we have 50-inch televisions these days as your regular desktop television. To have it in a square right. block in the middle of the screen and black on either side and you're struggling to see it. It was difficult. And that's not even leading into, you know, what the story was about.
You know what else is kind of a squarish aspect ratio?
What is?
Is IMAX.
Yeah, which is IMAX why I don't like IMAX.
Oh. Well, okay, listen, I get, you know, the aspect ratio is drawing. We're trained to see movies in a certain that either 2.49 or the sort of traditional rectangular look for movies. And so when the first shot opens up and you're looking at a postage stamp,
right,
I get it can be a little jarring.
It really was.
So all right, now we've gotten, it's a distinctive look.
Yes.
Black and white. Mm-hmm. Unique aspect ratio,
right.
What is this movie about, Arco Esposito?
At its core, this movie is to me about a man's descent into madness, or maybe both men's descent into madness, from the life that they're living, and their solitude, their loneliness, and how it affects them throughout the film, but obviously throughout their lives also. That to me is the main thing that I got from this film. And watching the film, I feel like we've seen this type of film before in 1980s, The Shining, where, you know, Jack Nicholson's character goes mad because he's isolated. He feels alone. He's working on something, but, you know, it's not working for him. And you see him going crazier and crazier as the film goes on. So I got this sense of this from this film.
You know, I did not think of The Shining as in comparison, but now that you bring that up, I'm sitting here and it does make a lot of sense. It's a guy, well, I mean, in The Shining, it's a family who are assigned to live out in a remote area to do a job for a certain amount of time. And right. In The Lighthouse, it's Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe are the lighthouse keepers for this remote, unnamed off the coast of New England, this lighthouse. They're supposed to be there for, what, 4 weeks?
4 weeks, right.
4 weeks. And then as soon as you get there, the sense of time kind of goes away.
Right, absolutely.
And it's almost as if they're stuck in some kind of purgatory and they're never moving forward. They're never moving back. They're just kind of existing in this stasis.
Well, the purgatory aspect of it really works because they both have, through the film, you can tell that you are told that they have done terrible things in their lives that at the very least they feel guilty about. So purgatory does work as a theme in this film.
Yeah, it's like these guys have to pay for whatever they've done in the past. And Ephraim, the Robert Pattinson character, right, he confesses to Thomas Wake, Defoe's character, that he kind of let a man die in a lumber mill, but he might have also killed him.
Right,
it's kind of left ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And obviously, Wake didn't want to hear that. And he asked him about 17 times, why'd you spill your beans?
Why'd you spill your beans?
I just spill your beans.
like he didn't want to hear it. He definitely didn't want to hear it. But there was definitely something to it that he knew that once he heard it, things would never be the same.
I think there's something to be said for both of these characters doing this job.
Right,
are fleeing their lives. They're doing this job because there's. Like you said, there are things in their past that they're running from, but essentially these are two people that can no longer function within the world.
Right.
And the lighthouse is a way for them to sort of be apart from everyone and be apart from the world because they're completely disconnected from society for the time that they're out there.
Absolutely. And William Dafoe's character, Thomas Wake, keeps on telling different stories about his life that don't add up. And Robert Pattinson's character, Ephraim, or, you know, Thomas Howard, as his real name is, you know, started calling him out on it as this story started changing. So, you know, the sense of loneliness that you got from William Dafoe, I felt that when he was trying to stop Robert Pattinson from leaving, taking the one rowboat that they have on the island. And he says, you know, don't leave me, please don't leave me, or whatever he says. And he's doing the best he can to stop him by using the axe to break up the dinghy. So I felt that was the only human part of Defoe's character in the film. Like, he was scared to be alone after that. So, you know, because he lost his first, the person that Pattinson was replacing, you know, we find out is dead. And, you know, he doesn't want to be alone for whatever reason.
I think the easiest way to talk about this movie, and you can get into, I think the easiest way to get into sort of the deeper philosophical and mythical origins of Eggers' story is for me to ask you, because I'm curious, because I don't know if I'm right or wrong, and the movie is really unclear or open-ended in terms of what everything means, especially the ending.
Yeah, it's a mind fuck. It's a mind fuck.
So I think I think the easiest way is for me to ask you some questions.
Sure, go ahead.
Just to get your vibe and your take. Okay. So we discussed the way the movie was shot. Mm-hmm. What do you think of the dialogue and how it's written and how these characters speak?
You know that I'm not a big fan of subtitles, but I had to turn on the subtitles because I had to see what they were saying. So not only am I bothered by what I'm seeing or struggling to see on the screen, but I have to look down and read what the hell they're saying. And only
so when, you can't.
No, only when I was reading it could I tell what the hell they were saying.
So this is a movie you could not see and could not hear.
It was like. It was a terrible Popeye film for me. It was so bad. No, I'm sorry. The dialogue was so terrible. It worked for the time, I guess. And reading the wiking this after I saw it, I read that that Eggers wanted it to be as authentic as possible, and he used a northern farming Maine accent for Pattinson's character and a kind of mix. Different kind of dialogues for Defoe's character of seamen and marine men. So I understand that that's what people sounded like at the time, but man, oh man, was it difficult.
Did you see The Witch?
I did not see The Witch. As you know, I am not a horror fan. While this movie could be described as possibly a horror film, I didn't see it. It wasn't scary to me. It was more a little suspenseful and obtuse, like what the hell? What the hell am I seeing here? So it definitely wasn't scary to me. The Witch, if I remember correctly, was a little bit more straightforward horror. And I'm not a horror guy.
Yeah, I'm not. It's not gross. It's not like certain Ari Aster movies. It's not gory in any way, but it's more disturbing. It's more psychological horror.
Yeah, yeah.
But The Witch takes place in a Puritan community in the 1600s.
Right.
And let me tell you, if you thought you needed a dictionary to translate The Lighthouse, my God, I've fallen in love with Edgar's style because it's so unique and distinctive, and I'm a big fan of artists who stand out.
Right, right.
But he's very into matching and not matching, but he's very into getting the New England dialect authentic for the time.
You know, for a young director as he is, I don't think he's over 40. I'm looking at a picture of him now. He really is going for the authenticity that you don't really see in films or filmmakers going for. I mean, going that extra mile. He would stop them in the middle of production and would tell them to either say a line, the three sentences in just a little bit faster to make it sound like these people were from that time and place. I like to know how the hell he knows what these people sound like, that to me is interesting.
In doing the research for this, I came across an Esquire magazine interview that he did after this came out. And Eggers is from New Hampshire.
Okay.
And he's very into the history and the cultural history of this part of the country. I'm in Vermont right now, like I said. And his wife came across, in researching for this movie, his wife came across a journal of one Sarah Orne Jewett, mm-hmm. who was interviewing farmers and fishermen and sea captains in Maine and then writing out her stories in her dialect phonetically. And he says that basically when his wife found this journal by this woman, that became the blueprint for how these characters were going to talk. Okay. And, it's definitely one of those your mileage may vary sort of things.
Right, right.
You're either into it or you're not. I'm into it, obviously.
Right.
But
so for me, I think what I was into and I really appreciated and enjoyed was the performance that these two actors put into this film. They were all in. They were, they were 100% sold on this film. And, Robert Pattinson, I think, is a great actor. I don't like a lot of his movies. Okay, I mean, the guy started out in Harry Potter for me, and I thought that was a fantastic film. I haven't seen a few of the other things that he's done. I know he's been an art house darling over the last 10 years in a lot of his films, and I know that you're looking forward to seeing him as Batman. And
very excited.
And Defoe is a chameleon. Defoe is not afraid of any role, which is amazing. We've seen him for the last 30 years taking on one film after another. He plays a psycho amazing. And it's not the same character, which is really my thing with Defoe, why I love him as an actor. You know, for me, the performance of these actors was the best part of this film. What the film was about, though, I have no idea.
Well, that was going to be one of my later questions okay, was, okay. You know, what you thought everything meant. But yeah, going back to Willem Dafoe, mm-hmm. my God, 122 credits on IMDb in yep. movies alone. Mm-hmm. And I think I first remember him as Sergeant Elias in Platoon way back
yep, yep.
In 1986. Yep, yep. But yeah, man, you're right. He's Dafoe's the kind of guy who has played everyone and every kind of character. He's obviously you love him, I'm sure, as Norman Osborn in the Spider-Man series.
He played it perfectly, I thought so. And but I loved him as a investigator in American Psycho. You know, a little bit understated for him, but it was a good role. He was great in Last Temptation of Christ. You know, however you fall with that film, his performance was spot sure. on. And, you know, he's done great, great work.
He is in John Wick.
He is in John Wick. And thank you for confirming that you have not seen that film.
I have not. Oddly enough, yes. I love Keanu. I love Ian McShane.
Yes. Okay. Well, we know where that's going.
you can throw it in there.
I sure will.
But yeah. Oh, man, he was also in Aquaman. I didn't see that either. Obviously.
You know, I'm not. Okay, we're not going to go off on a tangent on this one, but I'm not an Aquaman fan. That movie, to me, is everything that you think is wrong with filmmaking, okay? If you blame Marvel for anything, you're wrong when Aquaman makes $1 billion in 2019. I'm visceral right now, okay?
Is that just because people are so hungry for comic book movies that I don't know. When they know a lesser comic book movie is coming out, they're still going to give it a go?
Oh, it must have been. You know, Jason Momoa, he has a presence on the screen, so I'm sure that had something to do with it. You know, it can't be for Amber Heard, it can't be for Nicole Kidman, and the effects was, I mean, this movie may not have been made near water, okay? Even though it was underwater, it you know, green screen the entire way, and it was so blatantly obvious, and to me, that movie was terrible. Defoe was forgetful in the film, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I doubt highly I'm ever going to see it. But when you talk about a movie not feeling wet at all, The Lighthouse is the opposite, man. I think they do a great job, and I know they built a lighthouse out on the rocks, and then they built another interior set that they were able to use for the indoor scenes. But it very much has a feel like by the end of the movie, you feel weather beaten.
Oh, I was tired. I was tired watching
Pattinson trudge out with that wheelbarrow over and over again to throw everything off the rocks, all the garbage, all the trash off the rocks. Eventually, that just wears you down. Like the movie exhausts you. It exhausts you mentally, and it also exhausts you physically because you're kind of experiencing, in a way, because I saw this movie alone because my wife Nicole wasn't into it. But in a way, you're kind of watching this movie by yourself, right, if you didn't see it in theaters. And so you're kind of with these two guys, mm-hmm. and in an odd way, you're kind of experiencing what they experience, where you're just trapped with them in this space, in this square window into this world, and you're watching them lose their minds.
I felt exactly the same way, Jason, watching them, watching Pattinson's character going back and forth, cleaning. You know, we'll talk about the cistern in a minute, but I mean, everything that he was doing made me think, like, Jesus Christ, there were people that actually did this work, and this was a job that people had to do back in I don't know how far back, you know, when it stopped doing this work, but you can imagine that this life was out there for people to have. And they did it, and it was exhausting to watch him do this. It really was. And getting back to the cistern now, what the hell? Drinking water comes from the same, you know, it's, can you explain to me what the hell they were doing with that drinking water?
I think the cistern has to be sort of cleaned chemically to make the water potable.
So they were putting lime in it? Is that what that was?
I think, but wait, then you wouldn't be able to drink lime. No. Like, listen, I'm no chemist, yeah, me neither. I'm pretty sure you wouldn't be able to drink lime.
You're right. So I have no idea what the hell they were putting in there. Let's put it that way. So it was disgusting.
I mean, that's not the outhouse, because they had an outhouse.
No, like, they didn't have an outhouse. They just threw the stuff over the chamber pots over the cliff.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I think maybe, I mean, if you're talking about from a movie point of view, because Eggers is interesting in that he wants everything to be incredibly authentic and real to the world that he's into. Either, you know, the 1600s, a Puritan community, right, or this lighthouse off the coast of New England. So he wants everything to be authentic, but it also has to work in a symbolic fashion to serve the story, because obviously everything for him is a symbol to the story. And I'm wondering if the cistern is sort of these two men, or specifically Ephraim's soul being corrupted or has been corrupted, and he sort of brought this blackness onto the lighthouse with him.
I mean, I didn't see it like that. I probably the one thing that I saw towards the end of the film, when they were getting blinded, stinking drunk, when they weren't even bothering with the water anymore, that was their one life source, you know, basically their one source of life that they had was clean water, and then they didn't even care about it anymore. Now, and then they even started making their own hooch, you know, which was, honey mixed with turpentine, and they were drinking and getting blasted off of that. So, that's how I took it.
Supposedly, Defoe's Hark Triton speech,
yes,
was delivered in one take, according to Eggers, and Defoe did not blink for over 2 minutes.
Was that the speech in the when he was in the pit?
In the pit? No, that's when they're both stinking drunk, and he asked Pattinson if he likes his lobster, or he likes his cooking.
Basically, he was cursing him with that.
He was cursing Pattinson. Right. He lays a curse on him, because the whole idea is that, For what story there is, Pattinson at one point kills a seabird, yes, and Defoe makes it very clear that it's bad luck to kill a seabird.
Right.
And so, all right, you have that planted. Pattinson kills the seagull that keeps sort of messing with him whenever he goes out to the cistern or to throw anything away. He ends up killing the bird, and then things spiral out of control. Both of these guys begin to lose their minds. And throughout the movie, Pattinson is trying to figure out why Defoe will not let him tend to the light.
Yeah. God, I don't even want to talk about that. It was so weird. It was so weird.
So I thought when I saw it that Defoe had some sort of knowledge.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that knowledge could not be given to Pattinson. He had not earned it. He did not deserve it. And he's literally locked out from that knowledge.
Right.
And I mean, I'm not a student of the classics, but from what I gather and doing the research for this, at the end of the movie, Pattinson kills Defoe, gets the keys, goes up to the light. He's blinded, tumbles back down the stairwell of the lighthouse. Mm-hmm. And the next scene, he is naked on the rocks with the birds picking at his innards.
Right. Which
he's alive.
Right. Which basically completes the curse that he put on him, that Defoe's put on Pattinson in the pit while Pattinson was burying him alive, saying that he wanted him to suffer a Promethean fate. And as we know from Prometheus, he definitely did that.
Yes, Prometheus stole fire
from
the gods to give to the humans. And Zeus, in retribution, cursed him where he would live forever, and a bird would eat his liver. And every day, the liver would regrow, and the bird would come back, eat the liver again. And this was Prometheus's fate. For giving humans the gift of fire. Fire symbolically could be knowledge. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's an argument to be made, you know, again, your mileage might vary, that Pattinson is a Promethean character, that he stole the knowledge of the light from Defoe, and this was his his curse. Punishment. Because in that last scene, the lighthouse is gone. Like, the only thing on the island is just, or the only thing we see, the only thing the camera sees
right.
is him on the rocks.
That was really my only thought. I mean, I was exhausted when this film was over. It really was. Saying as he was being buried alive, you know, as he was being led out to his death on a dog leash,
right?
You know, and even that, you're like, oh my God, these guys are really lost the plot at this point.
You know, it's funny. I always find this fascinating, right? Because you and I, the whole thing with you and I have been what we each respond to,
right?
And the kind of movies we each respond to—that's the whole conceit of this podcast,
right?
And are you familiar with the platform Letterboxd?
Remind me.
Letterboxd is kind of a movie logging website where you can sort of track the movies you see. It's like a social platform, but for like hardcore cinephiles and whatnot. And Letterboxd has a top four. So for anyone on the profile, and you can, if you want to follow me and see what we're watching, you can go to Jason Allison, just search me on Letterboxd. I'm out there. So you have your top four films, and it's kind of interesting. I only bring it up because right now my favorite films, you choose for me, are Heat.
Okay.
2001 Space Odyssey. So Stanley Kubrick, Michael Mann, Stanley Kubrick, There Will Be Blood, PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson. And the fourth one, The Lighthouse.
Wow. Wow.
And it's funny how you had such a, and this is why I always find this fascinating, is you had such an unenjoyable time watching this, and I own the Blu-ray and I've watched it probably about four times in the last couple of years. And every time I think it's better and better.
That's amazing. I mean, you know, obviously we have varying tastes, but this movie did not speak to me in any way. All the films that you've given me, I've gotten something out of them where I can say it was a good movie. You know, I enjoyed it because, you know, I can't honestly say that a movie is good if I don't enjoy it. All right, that's just my opinion. Okay, you know, other people, you know, maybe it wouldn't win Oscars. I don't know, but to me, I did not enjoy the film. It was too much working against me. I understand what the story and the director are going for. I got nothing out of this film. I would rather watch The Shining, in which to me it has the same sense of dread from the beginning of the film toward the end. And lots of the same plot devices are in that film. I'd rather see that.
Okay. So then I take it you're not going to be online opening day for Eggers' new movie, The Northman.
You know what? Probably not online, although you shared the trailer with me. I do like a bunch of the people in that film, and it's in color. So I'll give it a shot. You know, I'll give it a shot at some point. I'm not waiting online for it, though.
Hey, Stellan Skarsgård running around. Wait, that's Stellan. That's not Peter. That's not Alexander Skarsgård. There's so many Skarsgårds.
Yeah, it's Alexander Skarsgård. It's the guy that was in True Blood.
True Blood. Yes, he's also in. I mean, he also did a turn in Succession this past season. That was pretty interesting. Nice. But he's real good. But anyway, yeah, it's Alexander Skarsgård killing people with spears and axes.
Right.
And Anya Taylor-Joy casting spells. And I don't think that's about everything I need in a movie.
Yes. Yeah, we do like her, so that's good. Very good. Okay.
Yes. All right. The Lighthouse. Not a keeper, but
it's
good to know. Not a
keeper for me. Glad I saw it. We talked about it a few years ago. Won't be going back to it.
Fair enough. I can say...
Okay.
I had a significantly better experience than you did this week.
Oh, boy. And, you know, that warms my heart. That warms my heart because here we are diving back into the MCU. Two movies in 1 week for you, where you did not watch another MCU film for 13 years. Here you are watching two in 1 week.
Two.
I feel you've come along.
One of those movies completely on my own.
On your own.
We did our special emergency Spider-Man No Way Home podcast.
Yep.
Captain America Civil War. Okay. This is my, second Captain. I mean, they're all the same.
Right?
Because now at this point, they're all. I shouldn't say that.
They're definitely not all the same. Come on.
I shouldn't say that.
But there's a formula going. Obviously, you picked up on the formula. You know how these MCU films are going to go. And like I told you when I gave you this film, is that you didn't like Age of Ultron. I totally get that. I totally understand that. But that was the turning point. This film would have been the turning point into where now everything that you know about the MCU yourself, Thanos, Infinity Gems, I Am Iron Man, and all that stuff started in this film. So this was going to be the important one, and I hoped that you would enjoy it.
So what I've learned is you've given me a bunch of Marvel movies so far, and this is my second Russo Brothers directed movie and Marcus and McFeely screenplay.
Right.
The other one being The Winter Soldier, which I enjoyed a lot.
Yes.
So I have a lot of questions with this with regards to your knowledge of sort of the MCU and how this works.
Okay.
But what I got is, as I'm looking here, and I wondered how much of this was related to Joss Whedon exiting after Ultron and having a bad experience with the Marvel system. Because what I saw is the Russo brothers nearly walked off the movie of Civil War. Did you know this?
I don't remember hearing of strife upon the movie, to be quite honest with you, when it comes to this. But you're going to have to tell me about it.
So there was a story written in Collider in 2001 where the Russo brothers state that they told Marvel that they weren't interested in going forward if they had to manage the politics of all these different requirements that the Marvel films put upon their directors and their screenwriters. Like all the foundational pieces. Every movie has to be a movie in and of itself, right?
Right.
And it also has to be the movie that builds the next movie and the movie after that and the movie after that.
Right. Which as you've said, is one of the things that you don't like about these films.
Right. So apparently, tell me this. This is the first time I've come across this. Before Feige had sole control, there used to be a thing called the Marvel Creative Committee. Are you aware of this?
Oh, I'm not aware of the Marvel Creative Committee. However, Feige was one of the producers on films such as Spider-Man with Raimi directing. He was a producer, I believe, also in the Incredible Hulk film, but they also had other people on it, like Avi Arad, who was the person.
Oh, I remember that name.
Yeah, was running the Marvel Entertainment arm of Marvel at the time. So it wasn't until Iron Man came along that Feige really took the reins and was allowed, anyway, to take the reins of the MCU going forward.
Okay, so according to
what you're saying makes sense, yes.
Okay, so according to this movie came out in 2016, but while they were making it, apparently the Russos had issues with the way they were getting instructions from the studio, and they went to Feige, and Feige stood up for them and said, hey, these guys can do what they want, they know what they're doing,
right.
And I think it worked out to be a better movie for it.
Absolutely.
But, I only bring that up because I'm concerned, okay? What I'm looking at here is that they directed those two Captain America movies, and then they went on to direct Infinity War and Endgame.
Right.
And with the same screenwriters, Marcus and McFeely doing the script for both of those movies. Right. So these are the movies I've responded to the most, these two Captain America movies.
Okay.
Because I think these do the best job of grounding all of these characters.
Yes, in the writing with the two screenwriters, absolutely.
And I think they did a great job, really, of laying the seeds of the issues between Cap and Tony Stark.
Yes.
And I thought, let me go to my notes here. I thought that getting to, because the whole movie is essentially built to get us to the airport fight.
Yes.
Right?
Which was fantastic.
Which was fantastic, but was that airport open? Was there's no other people around. Like, that airport might as well have been in, like, some desolate, deserted city somewhere.
I believe that you heard them say when they were getting ready in the parking lot that they heard overhead that they were clearing out the airport. So,
oh, that's good.
So by the time that they walked onto the tarmac, I believe it was a clear airport.
No. Okay. Well, yes, because we have to make space for all these super people. But yeah, like, I guess I'm at the point now with these movies where I get everyone's character and I get their personality. Vision is oddly hilarious.
He's great.
Paul Bettany.
Yeah, absolutely.
And again, he's another one of those, like, Cumberbatch characters where he's British and he's trained in a classical theater manner. And I wonder if he envisioned himself getting painted in purple and having an infinity gem
embedded in
glued to his forehead for, a few months, a year.
Like he said at the end of Ultron, he goes, he said, well, I was just born yesterday, you know, and he had some of the funnier lines in that film. And as you know, he had some good quips in this one also.
Yeah. So this movie, essentially the after the Havoc, the Avengers have wreaked all over the world. Right. Thaddeus, the William Hurt character who plays the Secretary of State. But his first name is Thaddeus. Anyway,
Thunderbolt Ross.
Wow, do you remember that just from your?
I remember it because he is supposed to be the father of Betty Ross, who is the paramour, as we all know, of the Incredible Hulk through the comic books and the shows. Not so much the MCU, but William Hurt's character was in the standalone Hulk film with Edward Norton, and they brought him back in this film to basically connect that film to the MCU even more.
Was he played by William Hurt Hulk movie?
Yes, he was.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Basically they decide that 107 countries want to the Avengers to essentially adhere to rules, mm-hmm. that they can't just be going off and running on their own. Right. And what I thought was interesting is you would expect, given what I know, and I wasn't the biggest Captain America fan, mm-hmm. but the fact that Tony Stark is clearly kind of an iconoclastic, go his own way, Silicon Valley-ish free thinker.
Yeah.
I was kind of surprised that Tony was the one that wanted to go along with this plan, and Cap was the one that had issues with just taking orders and being told what to do. Although, the more you think about it, I guess that makes sense, right? Because Cap took orders, and look at where it ended him up.
Yes. I think Cap is against it because he realizes that the power that the Avengers have can be exploited by nations if they so choose it. And he doesn't want to be responsible for, or you know, a soldier in a nation's army to cause damage and destruction against another nation. So he feels that they having their own powers under their own command is a lot better for everybody involved. And Tony's, to your point about Tony, he feels bad because that woman, you know, in the beginning of the film caught him in the elevator.
Alfre Woodard, she was the mother of the kid that died in Sokovia.
And Tony's been struggling with it. I mean, he's been struggling with it since Ultron. And he realizes that there are people out there getting hurt. He wants to save them. He wants to save everybody. You know, this is what's become of him. He's gone from being the rich philanthropist playboy to now wanting to put a suit around the entire world, like he said, during Ultron. And even if he lost one person, now he's feeling it.
They do kind of brush over the fact that in Avengers Ultron, Tony created a being that tried to destroy the world in order in his effort to protect it. Like, they didn't really reference that when they're having that conversation about why, when they're all the Avengers except for Hulk and Thor, when they're having that conversation about if they should agree to this or not. No one really breaks his balls about the fact that, hey, Tony, you built an AI that tried to blow up the planet. But
they definitely don't talk about it.
Yeah, but I'm looking through my notes here, and I think what I like about the Russos is there's kind of almost like a, in the action scenes, there's almost like a Bourne supremacy
of vibe. Absolutely. And like you said, it's rooted more in realism. These films, and you'll see that, I don't know how realistic Infinity War might be to you, but you'll get that vibe also.
Yeah, and that and the fact that they kind of ground the central conflict in a much more interesting concept to me instead of just like the destruction of the entire universe. I'm fascinated by this idea of exploring when you try to do the right thing, as the Avengers do,
right,
and then people die as a result. Does society blame the Avengers, or does society blame the other forces that exist that necessitated the Avengers to, you know, destroy Sokovia or destroy New York City?
Well,
and then
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No. Sorry. This film is based very loosely on Civil War from 2000, which came out in 2006, 2007.
The comic.
Yes, comic. And what happened in that film, in that series, that book, was a supervillain called Nitro, who had the ability to blow himself up over and over again, a la Daffy Duck.
Daffy's classic superpower of blowing himself up over and over again?
But no. But he could only do it once. But Nitro was able to do it more than once. And he did it in a place called, I think it was maybe Stamford, Connecticut. I'm not sure. But it was something like that, where he did it near a school where it killed over 600 or maybe 800 people, including 60 school children. And after that, that was... a few months after that, they came up with their own accords where people started taking sides and they wanted superheroes to be registered. And that's how that happened. It was a lot bloodier in the comics, and a lot of people didn't like that comic at all, that series, and including me. And that was the last time I ever collected comics. So it kind of ruined it on me. But yes, I believe that the way that they did it in the movie works far, far better than in the comics.
That's kind of interesting. And it does, it touches, because obviously the Marvel universe is odd because it exists like in our world, but not in our world. Like there are some cultural references made to movies or people that exist in our world, right. But also obviously this is its own universe.
Right.
But it does kind of get into those concepts of, is the reaction to a threat, does that inevitably become worse than the threat itself? And that's something that one of the other writer-directors I love, Taylor Sheridan, did you ever see Sicario?
I have not seen that, no.
So in Sicario, there's a great line, and Sicario is about the drug trade and what America is willing to do to try to stop the drug trade, specifically coming over in Mexico. Great movie for anyone who hasn't seen it. But there's a great line in there where the Emily Blunt FBI character asks Josh Brolin's federal agent, what are we going to do? And Brolin sort of smiles and says, overreact wildly. And that concept of... whether or not what we do to protect ourselves from threats ends up more damaging to our society than the threat itself.
Right.
I think it's fascinating. Maybe that's why I respond so much to the Winter Soldier and to this movie, because I think the ideas they're exploring are much more for me. And again, hey, teach their own.
No, I think you're 100% correct. And that's the one part that they got from the comics that does work in this, is that people are tired of, people are sick and tired, like Ross told them, of the destruction that comes along with the Avengers. Now, the Battle of New York, if they weren't there, what was going to happen? It was going to be, the world would have ended, okay? But, nobody sees that. A few years later, when people are still picking up the pieces, they don't see the bigger picture anymore. They only see the small picture in front of them that affects only them. And and they're trying to protect the little people, and the Avengers don't really get that.
Like in Man of Steel,
right?
The the Superman movie.
Yeah.
Supes and General Zod destroy Metropolis. And I don't know, I didn't see the second Superman movie with Henry Cavill, but I don't remember if that was, if that concept was explored in the same way. Did you?
Yeah, the second Superman movie was the Superman versus
Justice
Batman.
League?
No, Superman versus Batman.
Oh, so wait, I did see that. Yeah, I did see that then.
And yes, it was, it was, it was talked about because Batman
held you're right,
a freaking grudge against them the whole time. But, but you know, here we are. We're taking Zack Snyder, who takes, you know, who took such liberty with his view of Superman that people are still torn about that. You know, the fact that that Superman killed Zod at the end, or how much damage. I mean, you're talking at least tens of thousands dead in that film. You know, with buildings collapsing all around them. It was, I didn't like the film myself.
Yeah, it also made Superman too self-serious. There was no wink and a nod, but it, you know, that's another podcast for another day. I have a couple questions for you.
Go ahead.
Is this is, I'm assuming, Tom Holland's introduction into the Marvel Universe?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And so the scene with when Tony shows up at his apartment with, mm-hmm. he's talking to Aunt May, Marissa right. Tomei, that's the first time we see those actors in those roles.
Yes, it is.
Holland kind of was Peter Parker from jump. Like it wasn't like he needed a movie or two to ease into the role, huh?
I told you. He played him perfectly. I thought Toby was the best one until Holland came along, and he really embodied everything about that character that Stan Lee wrote and Steve Ditko put together back in 1962. He embodied that character 100%.
Yeah, I'm totally a stan for Holland as Peter Parker. Yeah. I can't believe I've committed. I've come
you're
around
in.
So from
you're all in.
From not wanting to see it. Yeah. It's just incredible right from the jump.
What I felt was even better, what worked even better, is that you never got a origin story, because we've already seen it twice. You saw it in 2002. You saw it in 2012. I don't need to see the spider bite him. I don't need to see Uncle Ben die again, thankfully. I mean, every time that they did, we saw Uncle Ben die twice. We've seen Thomas Wayne and Martha Wayne die three or four times in various media. I mean, you don't need to see that over and over and over again, in my opinion. So this worked even better. You went right into the Spider-Man character running.
Yeah, because that's the whole beef with like the Batman movies, right? Is we always feel a need to show Bruce's parents getting killed again and again.
Poor bastards.
And eventually it just doesn't work.
No.
Or at least you don't need it.
You don't need it. We know where Bruce's pain comes from.
Yeah. It's kind of part of our culture now. Absolutely. It doesn't need to be gone over to again. What is the deal with the Winter Soldier? He's suddenly, like, I don't remember him from the comics at all. In these two movies, he's like... the guy Sebastian Stan, who I totally think is Richard Madden from Game of Thrones.
Right.
Yeah, he's like everywhere. What's his deal?
So Winter Soldier was brought as a character in 2005, and he was known as the Winter Soldier. And it wasn't until a few issues into that comic book run by Ed Brubaker. I'm sorry if I'm
Ed Brubaker. Yeah, oh, Brubaker,
yes.
Okay, I have a connection for him.
Yes.
All right. I'll keep that in mind. Keep going.
Right. So he created this character, brought him back, and it turned out that he was Bucky Barnes. Now, up until that point, you always had, there were two rules, basically one rule for who stays dead in the Marvel universe, and that was Uncle Ben and Bucky, and they bring Bucky back. And it worked. It worked amazingly. And the way that they brought him back was that he was found when he, it was different in the comics than it was in the movies. But he was found. He had lost an arm. The Soviets, you know, basically put him back together again, and mind wiped him, and had been putting him on ice in between important missions of assassination. So he has been basically a ghost for the last 50-60 years. Only comes out when he's needed, and he's been working for Hydra in the comics. I mean, in the movies, as Robert Redford said in The Winter Soldier, you know, every once in a while they bring him back when he's really needed.
Yeah. Okay. So, because he's a huge part of this movie.
Oh, yeah. He's the reason why the Avengers split.
Yeah. So I was kind of curious on him. And also, is this Chadwick Boseman's first appearance as Black Panther?
Yes. And it took me a while to really come to grips with it being a good performance and a good entry point for him. When I first saw it, I said, the only thing that doesn't work for me was Black Panther. But I after subsequent viewings, I felt that it did work well. It was only me.
I think obviously Boseman, I think, had a great presence in every movie he was in, and died way too young, unfortunately. But they do enough work where even though he gets about 14 seconds of screen time before his father is killed,
right?
King Chaka, I totally bought that he would want to kill the Winter Soldier.
Yes.
Believing that he killed his father.
Right, exactly. And while it was actually Zemo that did it. So, and who also played by Daniel Brühl really, really well. Kudos to them for picking him to play Helmet Zemo.
You know, that is the thing with this, is that there's so many actors in these movies, and there's so many good actors.
Yes,
if you look at that, everyone only gets so much screen time to do what they can, right? It's like you're getting put into the game. You're like a backup, a sixth man, a seventh man on an NBA team, and you're going to get like 8 minutes, and you've got to hit like 4 3-pointers.
Exactly.
It's like everyone hits all their shots.
Yeah, I'm glad you see that, because you can get the characters can get lost in a film like this. We've seen other films where you have too many characters that get lost and their storyline does not get enough attention, where why were they there? It's a waste. In this particular film, that didn't happen.
No, I thought everyone serviced really well, and you cared. It made sense, and you cared about them going into the airport fight.
Right.
And listen, I had a great time. We are at the point where I do have to raise my few niggling issues.
That's fine.
Okay, you ready?
Oh, go ahead.
This is word for word one of my notes.
Okay.
Oh Christ, it's Paul Rudd.
You know, you and I are always going to disagree on Paul Rudd. I love the guy. I think he does a great job as Ant-Man, and he enjoys it. He has fun with it, and they did him justice in this film. Okay, I mean he's not just a superpowered guy, he's a superpowered guy just by circumstance, not because he did anything himself. He stole the freaking suit, you know, in Ant-Man. I know you didn't watch the movie, you're not gonna watch the movie, but he stole the suit and, you know, was able to keep it and everything. That's how he became this hero.
Okay, so yeah, this is because the movie, he shows up in the movie before this, which is Ant-Man.
Right, he does.
And is Michael Douglas in that movie?
He plays his father,
am I right?
He's not his father. He plays the original Ant-Man. Ant-Man in the comics is originally Hank Pym, and that's who he plays. And then Paul Rudd's character is the thief who steals the Ant-Man suit. And that is, I'm missing his name here. Hold on a second. Scott Lang. I'm sorry. I always get Scott Lang mixed up with somebody else. But Scott Lang is the second Ant-Man.
And that's the Paul Rudd character.
That's the Paul Rudd character, yes.
Okay. Yeah, no, he was fun. Listen, I don't hate Paul Rudd. I just think that Paul Rudd is similarly another one of those actors who plays variations of Paul Rudd in a lot of movies.
Yes,
but again,
I agree.
He's real good at what he does.
Yeah.
It's just more. My note was more towards yours. what was I going to say? Here's the other thing. Peter's intro at the airport is just excellent.
Oh man! When the trailer came out for this film and they showed that, I mean, I'm not gonna lie to you. I was amongst the millions of people that went crazy over it. So.
Another one of my little tidbits here. How much money did Audi give to the Disney Marvel corporation?
You will
to be every car in every one of these movies is an Audi.
Yeah,
I mean, that's just product placement stuff.
There'll be plenty of them, plenty more of them that you'll be seeing. Trust me on that one.
I'm sure. Tony Stark's father made Cap Shield?
Yes. So,
is that canon? Is that in the comics?
That is not in the comics. The shield was created by somebody else, another scientist in the comics, and it is a vibranium adamantium mix in the comic books, which you don't have adamantium in the MCU. You have adamantium in the X-Men movies, which is now part of the MCU, but they haven't brought it in yet. And yes, in Captain America, in the first Captain America film, which you did not have to watch, it was created by Howard Stark.
Who is John Slattery of Mad Men fame?
Well,
which
no,
is...
in the film from 2010, it was played by somebody else. I'm sorry.
Well, it's okay.
I apologize. I always forget that guy's name, but he was played by somebody else, a younger one. He was played in 1945. Howard Stark.
Well, I'm just whenever I see any of the Mad Men alum show up anywhere, it makes me happy.
Yeah, I'm sure you were happy.
All right, this is my one actual complaint about the movie.
Okay.
Had a real good time. Okay. And then this note came in at the two-hour mark where I said, these movies are just too long. Okay. At around the two-hour mark, they start to become a slog. So here's my thing. Mm-hmm. For like an hour and 50 minutes of the best of these movies, and I'm excluding No Way Home because I thought No Way Home was great all the way through.
Okay.
These movies, I think, would be a little bit better if they were like 15 to 20 minutes shorter. Because at the end of the airport fight, there's 32 minutes left.
So the two-hour mark must have been when Tony Stark went to the raft and like faced the group behind bars. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was a little bit before. Yeah, it was about when Tony's like, get the chopper ready, I think, I made that report. And also, that helicopter should not have been flying in that weather.
No.
I worried about the safety. But it was terrible weather. It was unsafe. Yeah, helicopters are dangerous. But yeah, because I paused it and I saw like 32 minutes. And granted, what I didn't know is that 9.5 minutes of that are credits and end credit sequences.
Right.
But still, that's like another 21 minutes of movie after the climactic fight. And I think they ended it. I think symbolically they ended it with Cap using his shield to destroy Tony's power source.
Right.
I thought that was awesome. Yeah, so it works.
Great. It was great.
But I was at a point where I'm like, man, leave me wanting more.
Okay. All right. I mean, I see that. They had to wrap it up, obviously, in that fashion. I hate to tell you, but the next few movies that you're gonna have to watch in the MCU are even longer. So.
Right. I know. Like Endgame is like 3 hours, right?
Yeah. Endgame's gonna be close to 3 hours. So, which you know, you're like, you know, 3 hours of this. But it works, in my opinion, it works for the most part. And you know, you'll have to take a break or something. But in my opinion, you'll sit there and you say, it was worth the 3 hours.
I'm not against long movies. Like I saw one of the last movies I saw before COVID hit in theaters was a screening of Lawrence of Arabia, which is like 4 hours long and has an intermission halfway through. So yeah. But these movies, I tend to find myself wandering in the fight scenes sometimes.
Is it because they kind of exhaust you?
Maybe.
There was a lot going on, you know, sensory overload in some instances, I would imagine. So much going on that when it dies down, you're like, oh, okay, all right, now what?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I'm drawn more to I'm drawn to the moments when they're not in the suits.
Okay.
Like... Yeah. I think everyone's acting their asses off and better than I would have thought before I started seeing these movies.
That's great. That's great that you picked that up.
But I much rather have Don Cheadle and Tony Stark sitting around shooting the shit with everyone than that shot of them in the suit with the computer overlays over their faces. Like that, I don't know. That just doesn't do it as much for me.
Okay.
But yeah, man. I mean, overall. Real good, like maybe my favorite MCU movie, excluding No Way Home.
Really? Wow! Even above Winter Soldier? Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's yeah.
See, this is progress for me. This is great. I love this. You know, unfortunately, you're going to start losing a lot of what you love in these films in the last two. And because the scope of it now goes way beyond where you're at. It goes way beyond the airport. It goes way beyond America and even Earth. Now you're going into space and you're going to bring in characters that unfortunately you have not seen yet, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy. So, you know, that which came out in 2014, and that was Marvel's way of expanding this story into, you know, the cosmos, which they had to do. And they did it with the Guardians of the Galaxy. So when you see them, it may be a little bit jarring for you and you may have more questions. So, you know, you just have to take that for what it is.
But that's what you're here for.
That's what I'm here
for. To answer all of my questions.
I love the fact that you got into these films, you know, to the point that you have, you know. You never really have to see them again, but you look back and they'll bring a smile to your face.
Hey, I've had a much better time with these movies than I thought I would at the beginning, which that's again great. Serves the purpose of what this idea was, which is to expose ourselves to different kinds of movies.
You know, while I felt all along that you were going to enjoy some of these films, if not most, I'm very proud of the fact that I gave you Greenland and you enjoyed it. Okay, so
yeah, that was not what I thought. No, that was a good keeper. Oh, real quick, we're coming up on time, and we try to keep it around the 1 hour, right. 5 minute mark here. Okay. Have you seen that? Basically, it looks as though the Russos will not be directing another Marvel movie.
Yes, that I heard. I think they're pretty much done. They were pretty much done after Endgame.
And they
said that. I think it would take a good amount of time in between films, away from that film, and a lot of money and a really good script for them to want to come back.
Yeah, which is a shame because it's clear that their two movies are the movies I've responded to the most and their sensibilities. But oddly enough, they directed a movie that I brought up when we did the Spider-Man No Way Home podcast that they directed Cherry.
Yes.
Which starred Tom Holland, that I didn't see, but I wanted to see. It didn't get great reviews, but again, based on a novel that I'm aware of that got a lot of buzz. So they went from the Marvel Universe to a very gritty story about an army guy coming home and robbing banks. So I guess they do want to do different stuff.
Okay.
And that's their right. But they made a damn fine movie, right. Captain America
and
Civil War.
And a fan out of you.
And a fan out of me. That is true. Right. So there we go. Captain America Civil War and The Lighthouse. Yes. One was good. Yeah. One was confusing.
Yes. Very good.
What do you have for me for next week?
All right. I've been waiting for this one. And I'm fairly certain you didn't see it because I spoke to you about Edward Burns a while back and you said that not a favorite for you. So I'm going to give you 2003's crime drama Confidence.
Whoa.
Okay, you never heard of it. Even better. Let me give you the rundown on this. Again, crime drama. The cast: Edward Burns, Rachel Weisz, Andy Garcia, Dustin Hoffman, Paul Giamatti. Let me go.
Oh my God. How have I not seen
Robert
this?
Robert Forster. Okay. I don't know how you didn't see it, but I could see that you overlooking this film. Didn't make too much of a splash. Generally good reviews, 70% on Rotten Tomatoes as of right now. I love the film. It was a little bit of comedy to it, black comedy. I thought Rachel Weisz's character, you know, Edward Burns plays a great grifter and has in other films also. So this is the role he was born to do. And I love when big actors like Dustin Hoffman get into these smaller films and get into it. And he really gets into this one. So the challenge is Confidence, 2003.
Yeah, this doesn't sound like much of a challenge at all. I will gladly accept.
All right, good.
Yeah. I guess we're going to kind of keep it noirish, like neo-noir, because I debated on what to give you, and this is a movie that I love, and I just look for any excuse to rewatch it. So I'm going to give it to you. Rian Johnson's directorial debut.
Okay.
In 2005, he did a little movie called Brick. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it, although we're talking about Rian Johnson, the man who ruined Star Wars.
The man who ruined Star Wars, okay, yes. Before he ruined Star Wars, and then he sort of reestablish himself with Knives Out. He started with a little neo-noir movie starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt that takes place in an unnamed high school in California. It's about a stolen kilo of cocaine.
Okay.
And it feels like it's straight out of the 40s. And I love it. I've loved it every time I've seen it. And I'm giving it to you basically because I want an excuse to rewatch it myself.
Okay. All right. Well, challenge accepted. Brick. All right. It will, and I love Levitt. So he's been great since he was a kid. So looking forward to it.
Yeah. I've always liked him. So that next week will be our crime fiction week.
Yes. Okay. All right. Looking forward to it.
All right, man. Thank you again, everyone. Hey, listen, if you are enjoying the podcast, tell a friend, tell two friends, maybe post about it. I don't know. Help us out here. It makes us feel good when we know that someone's listening.
Yes, it does. It does. And I do appreciate, friends of mine who, contact me after, the podcast drops. They tell us that they really enjoy it and they're looking forward to the next one.
Well, hopefully so will we with Brick and Confidence next week. So again, thanks for listening. This has been Movie Challenge Accepted. I'm Jason.
And I am Marco.
And we will see you next time.
Take care.